Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's Refugee Cap conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this call may be recorded. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Melanie Nisser. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, this is Melanie Nisser. I'm the Senior Vice President for Public Affairs at HIAS. We are the global Jewish organization that protects refugees. And myself, along with my colleagues, are here to talk to you today about the Refugee Cap. And first, I think I should explain what the Refugee Cap is. There is, since 1980, since the Refugee Act was enacted, there's been a process for determining annual refugee admissions numbers for the U.S. every year. That decision is made by the President in consultation with Congress. It is made prior to the start of the fiscal year, which, as you all know, starts on October 1st, just a few short weeks from now. The law requires that the President or the administration submit a report to Congress about refugee admissions and about what its plans are for admissions, assessing the world situation for refugees and the U.S. response. The other thing that happens before the presidential determination is made is that the president and the administration will consult with Congress. That has not yet happened either. So we don't have a report yet. We don't have a report to Congress yet. And certainly we don't have a presidential determination yet, or we're calling it the refugee cap. And that's what we're here to talk about today. The existing refugee cap, the number that was put in place before the start of this current fiscal year, was 110,000 refugees, and that was put in place by President Obama in response to what is now the largest refugee crisis in recorded history. More than 65 million people displaced, more than 20 million refugees, thousands of people being displaced every day from their homes around the world. So the question is now, what is the U.S.'s role going to be in taking responsibility to responding to this crisis? Historically, we have been a leader here. Mm-hmm. Historically, the U.S. has led the world in refugee admissions, mm-hmm. and we do that for humanitarian reasons. We do that for national security mm-hmm. reasons. We do that for global security reasons. And we do that successfully. Since 1980, we've resettled about 3 million refugees. They have gone on to become part of the fabric of this country, and those of us on this call don't think that that should change. We are calling collectively for a presidential determination or a refugee cap of 75,000 refugees this year. That's certainly not enough to respond to the crisis, and we also feel that it's not nearly at the capacity that the U.S. has, that we could actually resettle many more. But given where we are and what our political moment is, we think at least that would be a signal to the world and to the persecuted people around the world that have always looked to the U.S. for inspiration and for hope, that we still care and that we're still engaged and that we're still a leader on refugee admissions. I will say that any PD lower than 75,000 would signal a real retreat from this role, that even a refugee admissions number of 50,000, which is one of the numbers that we're hearing floated, would be historically low, that the lowest presidential determination was actually 67,000, and that was in the 80s. And even after 9/11, when our security concerns were at their highest, and as a nation we were at our most scared and raw, President Bush set the refugee number at the same level as the year before, to signal the commitment that even at our darkest time, we were part of the global community and wanted to be a leader in the humanitarian response to refugees. Mm-hmm. So before I turn it over to my colleagues, who will talk in more detail about some of the issues that we plan to address, I just want to give you some numbers. Mm-hmm. Just to show you where we are in refugee admissions, last August, in August of 2016, mm-hmm. the U.S. resettled over 13,000 refugees. This past August, we resettled 913. Mm-hmm. So that's really a huge drop in where we were and where we were going. Mm-hmm. Another number that you should know is that about 2,000 refugees are ready and passed the security screenings and are, all cleared to come to the U.S., but they, you know, have for the most part been put on hold despite going through years of security screenings. at our invitation to come to the U.S., and many have family members here. So I just wanted to set the context, and I'll turn it over to Ambassador Ryan Crocker, who's the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Melanie. I'm very pleased to have this opportunity. This is a defining moment in many respects for the United States, and indeed, as the UN General Assembly gets underway for its annual meetings for the world. We have, as you pointed out, always led on the issue of refugees. We have done that because it is part of who we are as Americans. It's right there on the Statue of Liberty. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Look, virtually all of us came here from somewhere else. It is quite literally who we are. It also has a major political dimension. The United States, sadly, has not in recent years led on the issue of refugees, and we have seen the impact that has had on European solidarity and unity. The United States has led the world since World War II over 70 years, and it's hard to think of an issue more important than refugees for the U.S. to lead now. So we have got a strong humanitarian dimension. We know how to do this, as Melanie pointed out. But if we're going to lead moving on into the future, we have to step up on this, and I would consider 75,000 the absolute minimum. If we don't make that gesture, we are damaging something unique to us as Americans. And also, if we don't make that gesture, we are much more broadly moving away from American leadership on this issue and on others. So look, I've served in places that sadly generate a lot of refugees. These are not terrorists. These are people all too often fleeing terror. So we need to make a stand here, and I hope very much it is going to be a stand that once again reinforces both our values and our interests.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Crocker. Next, we're going to turn to Mr. Abdul Sabour. He is a former refugee from Afghanistan who worked with the U.S. military.
Thank you, Melanie. It's a pleasure to be with all of you, and thank you for the opportunity. Let me just start by saying thank you for facilitating this, and just to be here and speak up and be the voice for many refugees who come into to United States for fleeing persecution and violence. And, you know, I was certainly one of those individuals who had no idea or no hope of future. I was certainly afraid of future at that time. I immigrated with my wife in 2014 in the United States, and ever since immigrating to the United States, the transition from going through the process of resettlement and perhaps from the transition from coming from Afghanistan to the United States has been a very difficult, perhaps, process, and we all had to, including my wife, we all had to pay a steep price in terms of leaving all our goals behind and yet having the opportunity, perhaps, to come over in a new country and be welcomed and start a new life and begin to develop hopes for future. But the transition overall, you know, and I constantly, when I talk to individuals regarding refugees and families who are fleeing persecutions and violence, this is larger because they perhaps a lot of the families that are running away from violence is you run away to those who are trying to have their arms open and welcome you. So historically, and as you mentioned, the United States has been one of those countries who have had open arms and have welcomed people who are standing against, perhaps for many reasons, against violence, against discriminations. And as being an individual who have helped United States in their wars in Afghanistan, I could see my life in Afghanistan turning dark every day and running out of hopes in terms of planning for future. And obviously, there are programs and opportunities where United States allowed individuals who have helped stand alongside U.S. soldiers to help fight those insurgents in many regards. So open the doors for us to come into the United States. And I think the transition to come to the United States was perhaps quite a difficult process in terms of adjusting to culture, you know, getting into the laws and understanding through the laws, and overall just learning a whole new set of language and making sure that you keep up with other residents perhaps as to competing for economic benefits and making sure you develop a life where you ought to or you dream to do in terms of that. So when I hear numbers, when I hear a lot of these things, you know, I had the privilege to walk on this footsteps of many of these folks to come into the United States, and right now I have the pleasure of working with many of these families because I grew up the passion to dedicate my life, my professional life perhaps, in a way in regards to give back to these individuals because I know exactly what these individuals are going through. So hearing numbers, and I hear the human side. I don't believe in any numbers in terms of helping because when you open your arms and start helping individuals, I base it against this analogy of making sure that we have you just simply help human beings rather than anything else. Because so when you put statistics and numbers with these individuals, it's beyond my imagination in terms of helping. Because again, we're talking about a population that are a set of population that are desperate for help, and there are needs to be heard. Their voices need to be heard, and there are not many countries in the world that are actually doing what the United States historically has been doing in helping out refugees. You know, you clearly mentioned from 1980s, the United States have been that country. But also, again, this is one of those countries that has built on immigrants, on refugees. And so I think from that standpoint, I'm a sole believer in making sure that we accept and open our doors to families, and including myself and other individuals who have come into running away from violence and are coming into for safety, for freedom, and making sure that they have a hope for their families and themselves. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much, Abdul. We're going to turn now to Michael Breen, who's the president and CEO of the Truman National Security Project. Michael?
Thank you, and Abdul, thank you also. I think you're an American patriot, and we're very lucky to have you in our country. I have to agree with Ambassador Crocker that this is a defining moment for strategic as well as for moral reasons. And first, to the security questions, let me just say, as has been said many times, that if you enter the United States on an international flight from anywhere in the world and there is a refugee family on that aircraft or an individual who has refugee status, that individual is almost certainly the most thoroughly vetted individual on that aircraft, including you if you're a U.S. citizen. The vetting process for refugees, no vetting process will ever be perfect, but there is absolutely zero evidence that a refugee is more likely to be involved in violence than a native-born American or anyone else who comes to this country, and they are the most vetted people in almost every case who enter this country. It's also worth saying that extremist groups that we are fighting around the world, ISIS is a great example of this, have a narrative that they are pushing to all those who live in the communities they want to dominate. And that narrative essentially says, you can submit to our rule and submit to our values and join our cause, or you can be killed for your refusal to submit. There is no third option. There is no third choice. Join us or die. And how we treat refugees, how we lead the world in responding to that, can give a lie to that narrative, can make it clear that there is a third option, or it can bolster that narrative. And there are massive strategic consequences to which decision we make in the fight against extremism and the fight against terror. There are also strategic questions, there are consequences in terms of American leadership, leadership in the face of the largest refugee crisis in history now, and leadership in general, as Ambassador Crocker mentioned. Asking others to shoulder the burden while scaling back our own commitment while doing far less than we can, that is not leadership. That's the exact opposite. That's the first thing they ever taught me as a young lieutenant in the Army, and it remains true on the global stage. And I think since we are really seeing a glimpse in many ways, and at this moment we've really got to think about what the world looks like if the United States chooses not to lead, chooses not to step forward. Since 1945, American leadership has played a major role in preventing major power conflict around the world and has done things like help Europe hang together. with us and meet some incredibly serious threats across decades. And now we find ourselves at a moment where I think we're all getting a look off the cliff in terms of what the world might look like if we decided to stop making those investments and if we decided to stop leading. This crisis is one example of that. And so I do think on a large scale we are at a defining moment, and how we respond to this refugee crisis and whether we lead or whether we step back and let the chips fall how they may, and they will not fall pleasantly, I think is a major defining question for us as a country. So this is about refugees. This is about the largest crisis in refugees we've seen since we've been counting. But this is also about something much more. It's about the future of American leadership in the world and whether we choose to continue what's been a very successful strategy since 1945 of investing in that leadership, or whether we choose to pull back and hope that things somehow work out without that engaged leadership. I am not optimistic that they will, and I think our allies in Europe and around the world are very worried that we may make that second choice. It would be a tragedy for us, it would be a tragedy for the world, and it would be a tragedy for our security. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. And our final speaker is Rabbi David Saperstein. He's the former director of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism and the former U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom.
I'm deeply pleased to have the opportunity to be with my distinguished colleagues here in addressing this urgent issue. And it's urgent both because of the global scene, but also because of the imminent decision that the president and the administration has to make about these levels. I am here representing the Multi-Faith Alliance for Syrian Refugees. It is a coalition committed to responding to the Syrian refugee crisis, comprised of nearly 90 faith-based and secular agencies, including from the religious communities, Buddhist, Christian, Hindu, Jewish, Muslim, Sikh communities. We, as part of this effort, not only deal with trying to ensure adequate funds to alleviate suffering and cultivating partnerships in the to advance future stability in the region, but advocating for sensible and humane refugee policies that represent America's values, strategic interests, and national security concerns. So I stand with the others, those 3 million people that have come in since 1975. They have made an immense contribution to the economy and the social capital of our nation. 85% of newly resettled refugees to the U.S. are employed within 180 days, and Syrian refugees in particular have higher educational and income levels than most other refugees. Now, I've seen from the inside the intensive vetting process of, inside of the government, the intensive vetting process to establish that incoming refugees do not impose a security threat. This is a process that can take up to 2 years of investigations. And it should be noted that not one of the 3 million refugees the U.S. has admitted since 75 has committed an act of terrorism. Let me also point out that the administration asked for 6 months of the ban, in part to be able to sharpen and improve the vetting, the already substantial vetting process. We've had much longer than that period of time, and indeed there have been some improvements that have been made. So this is a very strong process, and as a rabbi, I know all too well the disastrous consequences of what happens when the United States abdicates moral responsibility and turns away refugees at its shores, as has happened during the Holocaust. As a faith leader committed to interreligious expression, I know our collective voice speaks to the obligation as well as the value to our country to a humane and practical response to the refugee crisis, as well as our obligation to work to its for its resolution. And as indicated, across the globe, it is too often the poorer middle-income nations that bear the brunt of the refugee crisis. Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, having taken vast numbers of Syrian and Iraqi refugees, Pakistan bearing a disproportionate brunt of Afghan refugees, Bangladesh, of Burmese Rohingya refugees, refugees, Ugandan, Kenyan refugees from South Sudan and other nearby states. And then the overwhelming numbers that have flooded into those countries threaten to destabilize those nations and the entire regions of which they are a part. So we have a vested interest in helping to ease the burdens, not only by maintaining support for the UNHCR that plays such an important role in providing for refugees across the globe, but also by meeting our fair share obligation and taking more in. You've heard the numbers on this. I would point out, I believe, that President Reagan actually went up to 140,000 one year. We need to be doing more, and this $75,000 number of refugees is truly a base here. Hopefully we can go back to President Obama's number of 110,000, but the 75,000 is so desperately needed for us to maintain our moral leadership in the world and to live up to our own values. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Rabbi Saperstein. At this point, we'll open up for questions. If you have a question for a particular speaker, could you let us know that too so we can direct that? Ready for questions.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, please press star and one on your touch-tone phone. We will pause a moment to allow questions to queue. And our first question comes from Laura Meckler with the Wall Street Journal. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks very much. I have two related questions. The first one is for Ambassador Crocker. That you talked about how refugees are the best vetted of any travelers to the U.S., but administration officials will point out that some of the refugees, refugee applicants, just by through no fault of their own, but it's very difficult to find paperwork on them. It's very difficult to verify their travel documents. It's difficult to know what their potential criminal history might have been in their country just because that information isn't available. So how would you respond to those who say that, you know, actually it's not, there actually are holes in the vetting process that need to be filled? And on a related point to Rabbi Saperstein, you mentioned that you thought there had been some improvements made in the vetting process over the last few months. I'm wondering what specifically you're thinking of. Thanks.
Well, thank you. As Michael Breen pointed out, there is no absolute 100% guarantee or assurance. This is the real world. And yet, what we have seen through the processing of literally millions of refugees over the years, and again, prior to the current time, under screening that was less stringent than we have now, we simply are not seeing refugees associating themselves with violence and terror. And again, I lived in those places, Iraq and Afghanistan, and most recently, that if I were Islamic State or any other terrorist organization, the refugee route is absolutely the last thing I would pursue. These people are much more heavily vetted than any other class of visitor to the United States, and I would just add parenthetically, within that community of intensively vetted refugees, Syrian refugees now lead the list. Extreme vetting, we've got it. What I would be afraid of right now is that the focus on vetting and whether it's good enough becomes not the real reason for low refugee admissions. It becomes an excuse for some of our worst nativist instincts, just to keep piling on the requirements so that they cannot possibly be met in any reasonable time frame. There is a principle here, but principles need to be protected in the details. So certainly to my mind, the vetting process we have in place is more than adequate. I think to go beyond that, you are simply setting up an impossible standard to basically keep people out, no matter how they're vetted. And the last thing I would say on this is this is exactly what our enemies would like to see us do, to help them make their case that we are anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, that everything they've said all along about ethnicity and religion is being proved to be true by a government that will not take a leadership role on this issue, and that is constantly looking for ways not to make this country more secure, but to ensure that people seeking refuge don't get it from us. That is aid and comfort to the enemy.
And let me just add to that. The comment about there having been some improvements, I had picked up from news reporting that I had seen, and be glad to send that to you afterwards. So I can't identify what it is. I actually made a note to reach back and to try and get some clarification on exactly what that is. But my point remains that taking at face value, the administration saying it needed time to tighten the vetting process, it has had far more than the time that it originally asked for, and I'm very hopeful that that whatever steps it intended to take, it is taken and implemented.
Hi, this is Melanie. I just want to add just one more thing that I think people sometimes forget about or gets lost in the security conversation, is that when we're processing refugees overseas, we are not processing them from the country that they're from. So a Syrian refugee is not being processed out of Syria, or a Somali refugee is not being processed out of Somalia. Where they're processed from is the country to which they fled. So many Syrians, for example, are processed out of Jordan, a country where they've resided for years and a country that we have good relationships with. So there are some, you know, there is some security element there, that you must keep in mind. There was a story just the other day in the Post about, or I think maybe it was even today, about a Somali woman and her kids who are now on hold, who had been in Kenya for 10 years. The Kenyans take security very seriously, so we do have partners for vetting. And again, you know, so this to say, well, that, you know, we can't get the criminal record from the Syrian government. Well, that's not how we process refugees. You don't ask the persecuting government or the persecuting agency for the records of the people that we're trying to protect. So
right, but that's their point. That's exactly their point, is that you can't ask the persecuting government, but that person has a history in that country that we don't have access to.
Well, that person also has been in another country generally for many, many years. So there is a reliable security partner that we can, you know, I mean, and to dismiss all refugees because, you know, we can't get Assad to give records. You know, there are other very effective ways, and our system has shown that it is very effective in security screenings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, nobody asked, you know, again, I represent Hayes. I mean, although it was the security of Jewish refugees was in question. I mean, there were many of these same concerns were raised back then. Nobody said we have to go ask Hitler, you know, for their records, you know. So this is something that really we can do in other ways, and some of my colleagues can address that more thoroughly, I think, but that we have been very successful at over the last, you know, 30, 40 years.
This is Mike Breen. If you don't mind if I just jump in. I think the focus on records is an interesting one. I mean, let's not forget that this is usually about a two-year process that includes a number of interactions by trained security people with the refugee applicant themselves. The UN does that. They interview these people, but often some representative or contractor for the U.S. government, like the International Organization for Migration in Jordan, will then do an interview with this individual. And the Department of Homeland Security does a credibility determination of this individual, really plumbing into their story by people who are trained in interrogation techniques for exactly this reason, to find out if their backstory is credible and to try to detect any attempt to deceive the U.S. government about their background. So it's not just about their records in the country of origin. I mean, this is somebody who's, you know, in person with a great degree of detail being you know, having their background interrogated literally by a trained U.S. government security official. Not nothing. And add to that the security relationships we have with people like the Jordanians, who are no slouches, let's say, when it comes to intelligence and internal security. It's also striking the way that, you know, I spent time in Jordan during the initial Iraqi refugee crisis. The difference between the security measures that were in place on a routine basis then in Jordan and now is striking. You have refugees in Jordan who are using retinal scanning technology to access their stipends. And so these are people who are, you know, their biometrics are being recorded and being used and tracked on a daily basis as they go about their lives as refugees. So there's a pretty tremendous amount of information about these people and their habits and associations that we have going into the process that we didn't have before.
Mm-hmm.
I would just add to that when people flee, often there are other people from their villages, from their areas, who flee along. So you have a group of people who are able to provide information and background and information at all to test assertions that people make. So there are ways of you know, even without records, of finding out what happened in the original country.
Melanie, can I jump in real quick?
Of course.
Yeah, one of the things that I would say is, in considering my service alongside being an ally to U.S. forces in Afghanistan, it took me 5 years to come to the United States. I originally applied for seeking for safety in 2009, and I immigrated to the United States in 2014. So despite my contribution, despite my being an ally to the U.S. military forces, and despite going every 6 months going through a biometric system of screening to make sure that, you know, there's nothing with me that is against the U.S. government or potentially a threat to the U.S. government, it took U.S. government to do 9 or 5 years of the screening on me and my family before they granted us the green light to come to the United States. So I guess this notion that you know, there is not such documents, so there's not such information for us to perhaps come to a conclusion to say whether someone is a good or a bad person. It comes back to the point where you have individuals who have also helped U.S. government in wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places that have been an ally, and they're constantly going through the struggles of biometric systems or screenings to make sure that they meet. So can you imagine someone like me working alongside? So I have served with U.S. military for about 5 years of my life in Afghanistan. So I've worked with them for 5 years, and it took me close to right around 5 years to do the screening before I immigrated to the United States, before they issued me and my family the visas to come to the United States. So I do confirm the legitimacy, perhaps the legitimacy of the screening, that there is a very concrete, you cannot imagine the things that we had to go through, from meeting face-to-face, from medical screenings to providing documentations to, there were instances where they would even make us go through the interior minister of government of Afghanistan, where they would ask background checks of me and my family from both the National Director of Security and the Minister of the Interior of the same government, and they would make us go get sealed envelopes of letters to bring back to the consulate to make sure that we don't have any criminal records within the government of Afghanistan, and then let alone going through the other process of all the health screenings and then interview, face-to-face interviews, and all the other documentation that we had to provide, our identities perhaps. So it took me 5 years just working with U.S. government. Can you imagine how long would it take someone who's living right now in a refugee camp who's been there for many, many years?
Thank you so much for that. Can we take the next question, please?
And our next question comes from Yana Torbati with Reuters. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks. It's Yana Torbati with Reuters. Thanks very much for doing the call. Can you guys respond, whoever would be most relevant to this question, just respond to the argument that people on the other side of this issue make regarding the cost of resettling refugees, and specifically they say that resettling or supporting refugees in the Middle East or at least closer to their country of origin is far more cost effective than resettling them in the United States. Thank you.
Melanie, you want to take that?
Sure, I'll start off with that. Yeah, those are arguments that we often hear. And I guess on the first one, on the cost of resettlement, there are many studies that have come out that show that refugees are actually a boon to the economy in the U.S. So even though there is an initial cost, and I want to point out that their travel costs are repaid by the refugees. Many people don't know that, but refugees get loans to travel here, which they are expected to pay back. So there are initial processing costs. Of course, much of that is the security screening cost, which we need to invest in, and other processing costs. But when refugees come here, they're often resettled in communities where there has been, in inner city areas where they end up revitalizing the community. If you ask almost, I think, any mayor in the country, they're very supportive of refugee resettlement because refugees rent apartments, they open local businesses, they fill jobs. So you'll see, and it's not just faith and humanitarian and other groups that are advocating for refugee admissions. There are many business groups who have come forward and said, we support resettlement. So the closer you get to resettlement in a community, the more support you'll find because you'll see that mayors and others really do see the economic benefits that refugee brings, that refugee resettlement brings. On the other side of it, when they say, let's just support them over there, my question is always, over where? Where are we supposedly supporting these refugees? Countries like Lebanon and Jordan and Kenya and others, they've taken on the brunt of the responsibility because they happen to be neighbors of countries that are in conflict. But there's no reason why a country like ours that has always shown leadership, that's always been, the humanitarian leader on resettlement and setting kind of the moral standard for the world on how to be engaged with refugees, for us to just say this is no longer our responsibility, that it all falls on the shoulders of the countries which are much less able to deal with this than we are. It all falls on their shoulders and let them deal with it on their own. And maybe we'll, we'll send some financial support their way, which, by the way, although the U.S. has been quite generous in supporting, nowhere near the cost of refugee resettlement is being, shared by the international community. Countries like Jordan and Lebanon and Kenya and other countries, Uganda, they're shouldering much of the economic responsibility, and they can least afford to do that. There are kids in Lebanon who are going to school in shifts because of the Syrian refugees that are there. There's water concerns in Jordan. There's all kinds of, impact on the communities that are hosting them. So for us to say, well, just host them over there is not really an answer. Of course, we need to support those countries. We'll never be able to resettle every refugee. But, if the world really pitched in, we could come pretty close to resettling those who really need it, the most vulnerable, the ones who will never be safe in the countries to which they fled. So that argument really, to me, misses the point of resettlement. And I'm happy for my other colleagues to jump in on this, too. I'm sure there are others who can add.
Well, thanks for that, Melanie. This is Ryan Crocker. I'm on the board of Mercy Corps International. We're heavily engaged with the Syrian refugee crisis, among other things. We don't do resettlement in the U.S. All of our efforts are focused on the region, and it is exactly right. I mean, we do everything we can to support refugees and their host countries, particularly Jordan and Lebanon, for example. The sheer numbers dictate that by far the largest contingent of refugees are going to be out there in the region, not coming here or to Europe. So we're doing everything we can to create conditions that give them a decent life and livelihood where possible. So again, Melanie is exactly right. I mean, this does miss the point. You have to do both. You have to give opportunities for the most vulnerable to get to places of real safety in this country and elsewhere. At the same time, you have to make every effort for the refugees in the area and for their hosts. So it's not either or, it's both.
Okay. I think we can take another question.
And our next question comes from Willa Friedge with Huffington Post. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. This is Willa Fry with HuffPost. And I just wanted to ask, this is probably a question for Melanie, is there any way that Congress can reject the presidential determination about the cap, or once the president states the number, it's a done deal?
Well, Willa, as you know, in Washington, nothing's ever a completely done deal. And, of course, we're in a time of a lot of uncertainty and confusion around this. Congress has funded refugee resettlement through the end of this calendar year, or just about, or will, in the agreement that was reached on the continuing resolution, at a level for 75,000 refugees, which is a continuation of the funding from this year. Congress can also pass laws. You know, we obviously would prefer for the president to do the right thing here, but if he does not, we will be turning to Congress and expecting them to respond, because, you know, anything less than 75,000, particularly if it's significantly less, you know, will be unacceptable.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from Keegan Hamilton from Vice News. Please go ahead.
Thanks, guys. This is a question for Melanie or Ryan, I guess. We've heard some claims that the Department of Homeland Security needs to decrease refugee processing in order to address the backlog of asylum seekers. I'm wondering if you can address that, and is there any truth to that?
Yeah, so this is Melanie. I can try to address that first. So U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, which is part of DHS, was gearing up to be able to process 110,000 admissions this year. And they did that by finding efficiencies in the processing and increasing hiring of refugee and asylum officers to meet, you know, this demand. So given that context, it seems that, a target of 75,000 would certainly be reasonable for the administration to be able to process with the resources that it has. So, we can't afford it argument, we have to process asylum seekers, doesn't seem to make a lot of sense when, that the resources were there and they were able to find a way, not without a lot of stretching, but with commitment to resettle more refugees. So, whatever number the administration comes out with, it will be a lot lower, most likely, than the number that DHS was prepared to process. Are there other questions?
And our next question comes from Diane Solis with Dallas Morning News. Please go ahead.
Yes, I have a technical question. Would the presidential cap impact SIV visas for those from Iraq and Afghanistan?
Hi, I'm sorry, this is Melanie again. Those numbers are also announced at the beginning of fiscal year, but they are not technically counted in the refugee cap.
Ah, okay. Okay. Do you know how many most recently came in under the SIV categories?
Not in front of me, but that number is not that hard to find, so we could definitely
okay.
get that to you.
All right. Okay, thank
you. In fact,
you
may be able to find it at the State Department RAPS website.
I'm familiar
number.
With it. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
And our next question comes from Nina Keck from Vermont Public Radio. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Nina Keck with VPR. I just was curious concerning if the president comes out with a very low number, what sort of pushback are you anticipating from European countries regarding concerns about increases then in asylum seekers?
This is Ryan Crocker. That's a great question. What we've already seen in Europe, in large part a consequence of our refusing to take the lead on the global refugee crisis, is that we have reached a point of European disunity that we have not witnessed since the end of World War II, over 70 years. If we continue to refuse to lead here, both through a number so small that we will have no credibility, or just from a general desire not to get involved with this, it's going to deepen the splits within Europe, which is, of course, exactly what the Russians and others want. I mean, we saw in Syria, again, that the Russians basically weaponized refugees, that their direct attacks on civilian populations, the Aleppo area comes to mind, or abetting Syrian attacks on civilians, had as an aim here to start pushing more people out, hopefully toward Europe, to further weaken European unity. This is not good at all for the future of the international order. There have been two world wars that came about through European disunity. We don't need to risk another major conflagration. But this really concerns me, that on refugees, if we don't lead, no one else can, and the consequences are the kinds of disunities that are now appearing all over Europe.
Thank you, Ambassador. Are there other questions?
And our next question comes from Nick Blassi from PJ Media. Please go ahead.
Thanks for taking the question. I had a question for Ambassador Crocker. As you know, during the presidential campaign, there was a strong contrast between what President Trump laid out in terms of refugees in general, his refugee policy, and Hillary Clinton's. Given that divide during the campaign, how would you convince a skeptical voter who supported President Trump to get behind a higher number than what we've heard coming out of the administration so far for refugee admissions? And what do you think would be the specific implications for the United States, the most important implications that you would like to note, if they do not raise the cap to 75,000 or higher? Thank you.
Yes. Well, look, we all know that in our political system there is often some distance between what candidates say during a campaign and what later becomes policy, faced with the stark realities of leading the greatest nation on earth. So I very much would hope that that the president will take a long, close look on this to recognize both the moral and the strategic implications of a failure of U.S. leadership in this area. And I would point out that the failure we've seen thus far was really in the Obama administration, where they simply chose not to lead. Well, this is a chance for President Trump to carve out a different position and restore us to where I certainly believe we should be. How do you convince a skeptical voter? Well, it starts, again, with leadership. And I would certainly like to see political leaders of both parties make this a high priority issue. It's, again, it's who we are, it's where we ourselves came from, and most fundamentally, it's where we're going to go in the 21st century as a leader or not as a leader. And as all of us, I think, have pointed out, the consequences of an abdication of U.S. leadership are pretty stark.
Thank you. Are there other questions?
It appears there are no more questions at this time.
Are we permitted a final comment?
Yes, absolutely.
I just wanted to say how pleased I am that Abdul Sabur is on this call, pointing out the plight of those who risk their lives to help us, and then count on us to get them and their families to safety. I have to think that the very long waits that Abdul Sabur described for people who risk their lives to help us has a chilling effect on others, not just in Afghanistan, who are pondering whether they want to take the risk to help us again. There are no more fold a gap scenarios. The possibility of a pitched armored battle at the fold a gap between the Soviet Union and the West. Our wars now and going forward are going to be messy, difficult propositions, as we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan. Interpreters are absolutely vital to our mission. We cannot have any hope of carrying forward a successful military intervention if we don't have interpreters aboard who can help us sort out who's who, what's where, what we should and what we should not do. And again, I would have to think those contemplating whether they want to take that risk are going to look at what we're doing or not doing and say, nope, just not worth it. We will pay for that.
Thank you so much. Any of the other speakers have a last comment?
Well, Melanie, I do want to say thank you one more time. I appreciate you for having me. I really hope that the voices, our voices, are heard, and the United States' sort of hegemonic role in the in its leadership in the world continues to be as it was in the past, and hopefully will continue to be this way. So I with full gratitude, thank you so much, and I appreciate you having me on the call.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, thank you everybody on the call. I think we were able to give you an idea of what's at stake here and why this is so important. Certainly, if you need to follow up with any one of us with additional questions, we're available.